Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 18 of the Driving Eureka podcast. And in this episode, we're going to talk about being beyond reasonable. So the new innovation standard is beyond reasonable. That innovations can be meaningful, wonderful, better than expected. So first of all, with the theme that you picked for this newsletter, what was the inspiration?
So my high school sweetheart and my wife of many, many years, Debbie, for Christmas gave me tickets for us to go see James Taylor and his all-star band with Bonnie Raitt. And so we went to the show, and I, like James Taylor, had seen him before, was ready for him to be sitting on a stool playing the guitar, the typical, James Taylor kind of thing,
sure.
Right?
Yep.
And the show blew me away. It just absolutely blew me away, okay? I mean, so they did the little stuff right, okay? They started on time. I hate it when, you get there and they start 20 minutes late. He started on time. The headliner, Bonnie Raitt, was not a warm-up. It was a real show. I mean, a world-class show. The band, he says James Taylor and the All-Star Band, and that wasn't just marketing BS. I mean, this was like incredible artists. And they were treated by him and on stage with solos that were not just your token ones, but I'm talking like ridiculously good. And then the set, you think of James Taylor, you think of like coffee house, kind of cool,
Yeah, with Barstool, yeah.
We're talking about ridiculous, state-of-the-art video projection, moving three-dimensional elements, and video directing where it was like a movie you were watching, not just, some numbnuts hitting buttons, flipping from camera three to camera two and play video. I mean, it was really choreographed. I mean, I guess is the only other word for it. Hmm. But then despite all of this, so this is like big rock show. I mean, he's rocking it out at times. Then he did the stool thing, but the video took you to a whole nother planet when he was doing it. But, despite it's probably about 14,000 people in the arena, you still felt like you were sitting at a coffee house because both he and Bonnie were able to be fully present in the moment. And they were like having a conversation with you. Hmm. I mean, it was truly amazing. And as I'm going out, I'm thinking, what did they do? And I said, no, what they did is they went beyond reasonable. They didn't just start with being proper and prudent. They didn't do the things that expected. They didn't just tick the boxes and be good enough. They got to good. And then they went to ridiculous. And then they went so far beyond reasonable that your head just blew out. And I mean, even the encore at the end was like, okay, I've had everything I could have. And then they just blew you away again. And so I realized that when we do new things, part of it is we're stressed when we do innovation. We're stressed to get it done. We're stressed to get the work done. We've got so much to do to ship, or whether it's a new service or a new system, there's so much work to do that we end up compromising. But that's not what's going to help you win. What's going to help you win is get the fundamentals down, get your meaningful uniqueness in, and then after you've got your meaningful uniqueness, now how can you go to ridiculously beyond reasonable? That's how you create raving fans, not customers, but raving fans. That's how you end up with some old fart boasting that James Taylor is one of the coolest concerts I've ever seen. And Springsteen, of course, is at the top. You got Springsteen up there at the top, because the boss is the boss. But this was truly amazing. And I don't care if you like James Taylor or not, see this show. It is a work of real artistry and caring to do something amazing. And that's what we've got to get into our innovations. We've got to get that soul. And, you know, Trip, we've talked about craft. And this is the embodiment of the spirit of craft where you really, really care. And just amazing. Just amazing.
So, you know, as I listen to you, Doug, and I go through this, and I know you to be a very creative guy in the first place. And the fact that you pointed out this concert as being something unbelievable tells me something, that it probably truly is unbelievable, because I think it would be a lot for you to be impressed by that. But I'm also there's also one side of me, and I probably share this with a lot of people, which is, okay, but they're artists, they're creative people anyway, and you know, they're constantly coming up with new things. That's their gig. They got to come up with new songs, they got to come up with new ways to present themselves to the public, those types of things. But I'm a banking, or I'm in doing heating and cooling, HVAC types of things in organizations. That's great for them, because that's their industry, but our industry is to be proper and prudent. So what am I missing?
Well, okay, so let's take that in two steps.
Okay.
One is that, okay, so you work at a proper prudent bank that's well respected and well done. Okay, so all you have to do is just do your job and everything will be fine. That doesn't create growth. That doesn't create raving fans. That just says they're not stupid. Okay, they're doing what I expected. James Taylor does not need, in fact, one of the things that struck me is, my God, he must really care a lot, because he has no need. This guy's legend status, okay? He can just walk out and sit on the damn stool. He didn't need to have a band of 10 all-stars, which means 10 egos. Okay, let's just be clear. He didn't have to put up with that. He didn't have to have all the video craziness, which what it takes, you know, being in the digital space a lot ourselves, how much work that takes. He did this because of his desire to give his fans something truly amazing. I mean, this was – he cared to do something better. It wasn't just good enough. And I don't care what you're in, but you can take it to another level beyond. I mean, I just went to, I guess they're called FedEx now, but the old Kinko's. And I went there to print brochures for the Craft Whiskey Show, and I did it. And the guy there, I walked in and I said, and it wasn't busy, but I said, geez, I'd like you to print this. He says, oh, can you make it a PDF? I said, yeah, but when you make it a PDF, it sometimes shifts a little bit, so the margins are off. He's, oh man, I know exactly what you're saying. No problem. He said, tell you what, give it to me. I'll work with you. Let's just try it. And so we went through four times I made the PDF, and he went through to check it. And then he turned around and he says, I see the paper you're using. He says, you know, you can use that if you want, but here, let me show you this thing. And it was less money than the one I was looking at. But he says, with those images you've got, because we had some beautiful photos of the art, he says, that's going to just really pop more. I know it's less money, but I think it's better for what you – that was giving a shit, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's beyond reasonable. That's not just like, here, let me print your thing for you, you know? I mean, that was beyond reasonable. I mean, he took the time to do that with me. Now, to be fair, there wasn't a lot of line, and so it was easy for him to do it. But he didn't have to. He didn't have to do that. And that's what I mean. And so I don't care if you're working at Kinko's. I don't care if you're working at a bank. And I don't care if you're a legendary singer-songwriter. You know, it's about whatever that standard is, how do you take it beyond? How do you get people to say, my God, I can't believe what they just did?
You know, in a previous episode, we talked about going deep, and as you were talking there, I was thinking of this Kinko's, you know, customer service agent. I don't know exactly what the title would be, but this person obviously had skill and deep knowledge of what looks good, what doesn't look good. But it seems like there would also be competing things associated with that, like if the line was longer, you know, or maybe doesn't have the skill associated with it. is that what kind of pushes out some of the stuff as far as being able to be reasonable or unreasonable or beyond reasonable?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point. If the workers, I mean, it's fundamental, you know, Deming, 94% is the system. If the worker doesn't have the tools and doesn't have the training, then it's not possible for them to even imagine how they could help. And so it's a very fair point. Have you given your people, it's not a matter of just telling them to work harder, be nice to customers. They've got to know more. They've got to know what about it. They got to know what impact different papers have on different things that you're printing. I mean, if they're not taught those things, and you can't get it by osmosis, that's not reliable. One has it, one doesn't. But are they taught those things is probably a key element why sometimes people don't know, because they don't know. How could they know?
That's a fair point. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. Well, let's move to our Driving Eureka book segment, which is Tool Rules for Create Sessions. And matter of fact, Doug, as I started to read this, I sit there, okay, are we moving off of our theme? You're going back to the create sessions associated with Beyond Reasonable, but you kind of pull it back into this. But you identify these two rules for create session. Create session, for people who maybe don't know, is kind of the beginning of the process. Find, filter, fast track, big ideas, finding a big idea and going through the process of creating something that's not there. So why don't you take us through these two rules?
Well, I mean, the basic dimension here is okay, so I say beyond reasonable and you go, okay, fine. You know, what do you mean? And so you need to have some stimulus. You need to spark some stuff. We need to get the juices flowing. And the best way I know is through a create session. And as you know, we've done a lot of research on the value. We've talked about a stimulus and diversity and driving out fear. But at its root also, there was this fellow named Alex Osborne, 1942, writes a book called How to Think Up. And he's the guy who invented it. Yes, there is a guy who invented the concept and the name brainstorming. Okay. And in that book, he outlined two fundamental principles that were the key, which are embedded in all that we teach and what's written in Driving Eureka. And in Driving Eureka, I give a shout out to the work of Alex Osborne of there was a New York ad agency, BBDO. He was one of the O's. It's laid out two principles that were key, which we have found today. I revalidated them, and they're as true then as they were now. Sometimes people say three and four rules. That's wrong. The book has two, is what he says, and it's really two. That when it comes to creating ideas, and we'll just link it directly, that are beyond reasonable, that are really opening up our mind to the what if, there are two fundamental rules. One is suspend judgment, and number two is quantity creates quality. So the first thing you have to do is you've got to suspend judgment. When you're sitting there with ideas, if you put out an idea and you immediately kill it, soon no ideas are suggested. And, you know, if I align this with our stimulus response approach, where the stimulus acts as stimulus for more ideas, the minute I say something, that idea sets off a chain reaction of other ideas, which causes somebody to say something, which causes somebody else to say something, which causes somebody else to say something. And next thing you know, you're at a cool idea. So bad idea plus another idea plus another idea plus another idea equals a wicked cool idea. And that's the basic meant what I'm talking about. The tendency we have is when people get into a negative mode is what they'll turn around and do is the minute somebody says that, well, that's stupid. Well, so you never get then the chain reaction that can get you to wonderful. You get to nothingness. And so you have to open it up as a way to do it. And in fact, one of the things I do, and I tell in the newsletter, one of the things that we write about the book is when I've seen senior leaders don't realize it, but even with just their body language, they communicate. And so when I'm working with a senior leader, one of the things I tell them to do is I said, okay, I want you to go into a group while we're creating ideas. And I want you to not say anything, just listen. And then the group ends, and I said, so what'd you get? Well, they were okay, but not really that great. Okay, I said, now I have to tell you what I want you to do in the next group. I want you to be one of the first people to speak, and I want you to say the dumbest thought you can possibly have. He said, what do you mean? I said, no, I want you to say something stupid to expand the world, and I want you to listen. He said, well, I don't know anything. I said, well, here, I'm good at stupid, so here's a couple of stupid things. Pick one of these. So they go in and they come out after us. I said, what'd you say? I said, he said, it's amazing. I said the stupid thing like we talked, and it was amazing how many ideas came out that were better. I said, well, here's what happened. In their heads, they went, they have ideas. Your people have ideas. They've got the ideas. But they're scared to say them. It's the fear thing. Uh-huh. But when you said something stupid, they thought, well, at least I can say that because it ain't as dumb as what the boss says.
Well,
and it works.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I could see that there. It's kind of manipulating the group, but at the same time, you know, I wonder how often, Doug, as you've done these, where you've actually had to go to an executive. Well, let's just kind of get an executive mind frame. Okay, I'll do the blue card, you know, as far as setting the mission and coming up with a narrative. That sounds very executive like. Type of thing. But my job really is judgment, as most people think of their job in management, unfortunately, is to basically judge and be this kind of, I don't know, idolic character, in, you know, within the organization that has all the right answers. Do you find yourself often having to just kind of remove those people from the idea creating sessions because they're so negative? I mean, yeah, no. But I mean, you say, I get that, but you say no, but I mean, that's a tough road, not only for the executive to overcome, but also the fear associated with the way so most organizations, as we've talked about before, is run with that fear.
Well, but it's not as bad as that. It's really not as bad as that. Mostly they don't know. And when you sit there and you educate them and you show them that there's a system for this, that they're not expected to, you know, be a creative fountain, but to work, and that it's a stimulus or response system, and that there's a system to it. Most of the time, there's not an issue. Now, sometimes they'll opt out; they won't do it. Hmm. But I, you know, it's really simple. You know, you just to say, hey, you know, what kind of when you've had somebody that really inspired you to do something, what was it like? You know, when you had a coach or something, and they said, well, geez, yeah, I had a coach. I played football, or I played, you know, and I go, yeah, they were with the team. They were not separate from the team. They were part of the team. And so I need you to coach. I need you to give them safe space. I need you to encourage and to lead. I need you to lead, not manage. And we give them a role, and we show them how to do it, and we provide coaching and support to them. I mean, frankly, when we do innovation engineering, over half the work is with the leadership in a nice way, not in a mean way, but they've not been taught how to lead in this new world where ideas have to happen a lot faster than they used to do. The days when we could do, you know, reviews up and down the path are gone. It's too late. And so I am encouraged that there is much more of an openness to this, but you can't assume that they get it. You have to take the time to teach them, and you have to coach them and support them. I mean, Maggie Nichols, CEO of the Ranch, just told me there's a client that's signing on for a 3-year engagement to create a culture of innovation, and the leader pulled her aside afterwards, the CEO, took her into his office and said, you do know I'm going to need your help for me to do this. And there's more and more of that coming. I'm very, very encouraged. But you just have to do it gently. You can't make them feel bad. You can't make them feel stupid. You can't beat them up. You got to help them. You got to help.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit also about this quantity creates quality piece. Now, this is very Deming, right? So, I mean, this goes back to the conversation that you had with your father, you know, that you can actually increase your productivity by having higher quality. So it kind of fits into the overall theme of kind of the Deming frame of thought. But it is also counterintuitive from a standpoint of, well, how does quantity create quality?
So, you know, oftentimes what we'll say is we'll try to get to one idea and then optimize it. It's like taking one hole and continuing to drill for oil. Mm-hmm. And you hit bedrock, and it's just get a bigger drill bit and keep drilling. Instead, what you want to do is to try a lot of test holes and kind of see how things are going so that you can find the way to hit oil or gold or whatever you're trying to do. And Dr. Andy Van Gundy, bless him, he's passed, from the University of Oklahoma, he and I did a test where we measured teams and looked at the number of ideas they created, and then we independently, in this case we had Frito-Lay, evaluate the ideas, not knowing which team they were from, for which were really big ideas and which were not. And sure enough, the teams that did the most ideas had the most big ideas. Now, interestingly, you might look at that and say, okay, yeah, so they had more ideas, they got more big ideas, but they probably had a lot of ideas that were dumb. Yeah, they actually had more dumb ideas too. It's mm-hmm. a package deal. But all you need is one great one. And when you what Osborne says, what Van Gundy's research that we did says, is that you really need to go for quantity. And part of it is, again, the stimulus model, that stimulus acts as a spark to help people come up with more ideas.
Okay. On the use of – so is this because as the quantity and utilizing the – because we've talked about stimulus before, is that as you get more and more out there that you're going further out, or did you do this research even before you really understood stimulus?
We understood stimulus, but this was a separate study that we just did. They were all using
pure
stimulus
volume.
Diversity. But it was just literally the quantities that they did, because teams will have a tendency. We've learned over the years that teams will have a tendency to push until they get a big idea and then they relax. And in fact, one of the things we learned is we would measure the productivity of ideas from the morning versus the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And generally, when teams hit some big ideas in the morning, we learned to go into a panic, because they would then coast in the afternoon. And so there really is a stupid psychology here. They start out with an anxiety, I can't do it. And then they get it and they go, okay, I got it, I'm good. I can just blow off today. You know, I'll have a big lunch.
The big exhale, huh?
That's right. And so we usually, you know, turn it up after lunch and get them swept up in it. And again, this is all a psychology. We teach it in our innovation engineering black belt course. I talk a lot about it in Driving Eureka. These are sort of some of the psychological methods that you have to use to get people to do great things.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Beyond reasonable whiskey products, how do you make a whiskey? Well, you and I both know from having conversations with people, it's a pretty, using your word, prudent, seems to be customers of whiskey. So how do you go beyond reasonable with whiskey?
Well, I mean, first off, like all craft companies, beyond reasonable is not just a slogan. It's in the DNA. I mean, you're not a craft company. You're not a true craft company if you don't have a beyond reasonable dimension in you. That's just a caring to just go crazy to create real fans. In the case of us, we have our way. Everybody's got their own way, and I'm cool with that. You know, we've run over 400 quantitative, statistically significant taste tests to define our products and to make ourselves smarter. We hand sort every piece of wood 3 times before we use it in time compression, because that wood has to be exactly right before we do it. We only use air dried, not kiln dried. Kiln dried, the industry with the growth of bourbon has gone to kiln dried, and it just doesn't have the taste character. You kill a lot of the taste when you cook it that the air dried doesn't do. And it costs a little bit more, but the flavor is amazing.
This kiln dried versus the air dried, you've got this compression age process that makes things go faster. And it's almost like you're buying time to do your air dried as your expensive proposition versus where they're trying to get speed is on doing something kiln dried, which compromises the taste, if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly. Right.
Everybody's got their own house style.
Yeah, okay.
Our focus is we want to have richness yet clean. We want to have the richness like a scotch has, a lot more complexity versus bourbon, which tends to be more simple and just by its nature. But bourbon's a lot cleaner than the scotches are. And so what we look for is real richness, but clean. So not that singular corn note in our bourbon, but a lot more complexity to it. And that's our house style. And to do that, we have to go beyond reasonable on some things in order to get the style that is the style that we like to drink. And that's what we're making. So when people taste it, they go, "My God, I've not had anything like this." And I'm like, "Well, that's the idea." Good. So they ask it like a question, like, "I've never had anything like this, have I?" Okay, well, I hope not, because otherwise I'm glad I wouldn't be shipping it.
Is the story part of this? We talked in a previous episode about the story. Is going beyond reasonable? Is it the not just the crafting of the whiskey itself, but the complete package of things? Everything from the way it looks to the story to the
yes, it is. But I'm going to be biased, and I am an old fashioned make a frickin' better product. And that's why I like blind taste tests. That's, to me, is the epitome of it. The problem with the marketing spin, which is important, and you have to have it, and we do that. But the problem with that is where that leads to is selling the same old crap as everybody else with just marketing flim-flam on it. And that's the taste of death. I mean, you're just going to die. I'm talking about build a better product. I mean, the Macallan, I mean, our partners, full disclosure, using sherry oak casks and making a commitment to them results in a taste that is tangibly, meaningfully different than any other Scotch whiskey in the world. I mean, it's just different. I'm just sorry. It is. It's a different taste. You taste a Macallan, you know it's a Macallan. That's what we're trying to do. And this, to me, one of the great challenges in all categories, but whiskey in particular, is we've got a lot of people making good enough products that, frankly, if you tasted 10 of them, you couldn't tell the difference between them because they're all pretty much the same. That's not craft. That's not beyond reasonable. Being reasonable is cloning, you know, one of the mass market, you know, Johnny, Jim, or Jack's products kind of thing.
Okay. And so as you start to look beyond reasonable, and maybe I'm going down a path that maybe you wouldn't go down, but you've kind of focused in on the wood. You're running all these taste tests and doing different things. But are there other things that you're starting to look at, or you're saying, "Oh, but that might make a difference too," as far as whether it's ingredients or maybe it's just down that wood path that you're going deeper on and learning different types of wood. But if you were to look to the future of, you know, whiskey, we've talked about different drinks and things like that associated. Are there other things that you're seeing on the horizon as far as things that, "Oh, you know what? We ran this test. At some point, I'd like to go down that path." Are there things like that that you have?
Well, without giving out too many secrets.
Okay.
yes, there are. But remember the big picture. 70% of the flavor of whiskey comes from wood. Okay? That's the reality. 25% comes from the grain choice that you have, and 5% comes from the distilling. Now that's assuming you distill good. Distilling bad is incompetent. So that's we're going to throw that out. But, you know, so the next thing after the wood, which is 70%, so it's 70% at least of our efforts. The next thing is the grain, and the key with the grain is not just the selections of grains, which we can do now. But I've talked about this before, you know, heritage grains. We've been doing some stuff with some heritage organic grains, which, you know, before mass farming, grains, they may not have been as stable. They didn't grow. They didn't give as high a yield, but they had a lot more flavor to them. And over time, we've bred the grains so that they grow well no matter what the climate is, and you get a high yield of sugars and stuff from them. And so by going back to some of these heritage grains, we're starting to see, and we've only run maybe a half dozen experiments with it, but we're starting to see that you can develop some unique tastes and unique characters that you can't get from the modern, you know, factory farm grains. You know, the thing, one of the things that's crazy is, you know, we've got this world and people say they're craft and, oh yeah, I'm craft, I do craft, but they're buying the same damn, you know, conglomerate grain grown by factory farms. You know, my buddy Jarrett up in Nova Scotia, he grows his own, you know, and uses it. And so he's getting a unique taste as a result of that. Now, that's a lot of work. You know, his view is you're not real crafted if you don't plant the seed. I'm like, dude, man, that's pretty severe. But, you know, so everybody's got their own thing that they're going to do, and I'm cool with that. But the Heritage Grains is going to explode in the industry. It's going to be a big area to do it. Matched with woods, because you start to get some off taste, so you got to then manage the process, and it's not as simple as you just throw it into barrels. You know, that will be an area that we'll be looking at.
Okay, I got to ask a stupid question. What exactly is the operational definition of heritage grain? What does that mean?
I'm not sure. I don't know what the internet would say it is, but they're generally some of the original grains, like red fife wheat is a grain came from Scotland, planted across Canada, and, you know, and it has a nuttiness to it that the farmer who grows organically on our farm in Prince Edward Island that my wife and I have, he grows red fife and, you know, he grinds some of it for us. And, I mean, you make pancakes with it, and it's just got this amazing richness of flavor and a nuttiness that's just incredible. So it tends to be the ones pre – the genetic engineering. Now, it's not genetic engineering, but the plant breeding.
I got you.
That was done to optimize stuff.
All right. You know?
So,
interesting. Okay. All right. Do you want to provide us a little bit of an update on both the conference that you got coming up and the Brain Brew Whiskey Distillery / compression aging, what's happening, I guess, with your distillery?
Well, we're about to we're finishing up an arrangement in the UK. I've got conversations going on in some other countries as well, that we're talking to people to open up distilleries. In fact, I was on the phone with Europe with another country that's interested in doing it. This one's down in the Mediterranean, so I'm excited about that,
especially
the winter time. And so we're doing that. But at the craft show, we're going to be looking for a collection of pioneers. Our goal is to get a small number of pioneers this year to basically help build new pathways for profitability for craft distillers. It's not this or what they're doing. It's this and what they're doing. And so we're presenting a number of different options for people as ways to do it. And so we're looking for sort of those pioneering spirits. We consider 2019 to be kind of our beta year. And then with that, mass expansion in next year. And so whether that's with new countries, starting with the UK this year, or it's with more, you know, there's 2,000 distillers across the U.S., working with more of those across the U.S. as we expand out. We're basically going to do a small amount to start and then grow from there.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move to our Algonquin cocktail, or Algonquin, I guess there's two ways to pronounce it. A 1919 cocktail with a Brain Brew twist. So this is an original then?
Yeah, this is a classic. You can look it up. It came from the Round Table at the Algonquin Hotel in New York City, where the artists used to get together and sit and drink. We're taking out – it's basically a – you know, we're taking a bourbon, sweet vermouth, and a juice. And classically, it was done with pineapple juice. And we're substituting grapefruit juice with it. And adjusting the quantities a little bit to get to a better balance. And it really, I think this is, because I was trying to think of what's a beyond reasonable cocktail that you would taste and you go, whoa, that's not what I expected. And you're not used to having a whiskey martini, shall we say, you know, in a champagne coupe. You're not used to having it that way. And so what this does is you take an ounce and a half, and it's in the show notes, an ounce and a half of our paddle wheel bourbon is what we use with it, which is the 200-year wood. And if you don't have that, you can get another craft bourbon. Half ounce of sweet vermouth, and we tend to use Dolan, but you can use what you want. And then a half ounce of grapefruit juice. And again, to be beyond reasonable, you've got to squeeze the grapefruit. Canned and bottled is a reasonable thing to do. Be unreasonable. Squeeze it. Squeeze the grapefruit juice. Shake it with ice and then stir and put it in a martini glass for a very elegant cocktail that's made with bourbon, you know, that you would not expect. You know, you're not expecting cocktails in champagne glasses. And I think what you're going to see is a real growth of these whiskey-based champagne, you know, with some champagne thrown in it. You could add champagne to this. But in that kind of martini coupe, I think is what you're going to see. And it's just an elegant drink. It's just a very elegant drink. Not at all what you'd expect.
So is this the did you change the recipe, or is this
right.
Did it actually have bourbon in it and sweet vermouth and?
Yeah, but it had pineapple instead of grapefruit.
Ah, okay. So that's the main difference.
They classically would put more. So we cut it to a half ounce. They usually use 3/4 ounce of vermouth and pineapple, and we cut it back to a half because I just think it's got a better balance. Now, you taste it yourself. I mean, you may adjust it up and down, obviously. But that's how we find it to be quite elegant. And in particular, in this case, what happens with ours, with our paddle wheel, which uses 200-year wood, you've just got that incredible richness of the old wood in there, and it just sets it off. And so you get this kind of like mind-blowing taste that you go, wow, that's got complexity to it. It's not like a sugar drink. It's not a girly drink. It's not a guy, you know, harsh drink. It's a drink for humans to have that has this nice balance between the sweet vermouth, the tartness of the pine of the grapefruit, and then the bourbon with the corn bourbon. It really comes together nicely.
Okay, all right. Well, Beyond Reasonable. You can be beyond reasonable with whiskey products, as I guess what I learned during the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Any final comments on that?
Well, yeah. Beyond Reasonable is just part of life. It's what we're doing, and this applies not just to products and whiskey, but it also applies to our life, how we deal with our partners, how we deal with our kids, how we deal with our community. What can you do that goes beyond reasonable? Try it. Try doing something beyond reasonable and see how people react. Maybe they'll do it for you too. It's pretty cool.
All right. Okay. Well, that concludes this episode of the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book, a subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions, and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.DougHall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.